Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual, responsibility, what's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When poet Tracy K. Smith looks out, she looks in, out to nebula and the dark where stars glisten like ice, in to grief and love and creation, literally the moment when new life tumbles into her. Her father was an engineer on the Hubble Space Telescope. She is one of the most moving poets of her generation. And she brings in David Bowie and Charlton Heston and her own space odyssey to boot. This hour On Point poet Tracy K. Smith is with us. You can join the conversation. Do you still look up and out to help figure out what's down and in, inside? Joining me now from New York City is poet Tracy K. Smith, professor of creative writing at Princeton University, author of the collections Duende and The Body's Question. Her new book of poetry is Life on Mars. Joel Brower in the New York Times praises her for her extraordinary range and ambition. Tracy K. Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is really great. I hadn't read you before, and what a pleasure. What a way to come back from summer and find this bracing book, collection of poetry, waiting for me. I loved it right from the first. Would you read The Weather in Space for us, Tracy, from just right off the top of your collection?
I'd love to. The Weather in Space. Is God being or pure force? The wind or what commands it? When our lives slow and we can hold all that we love, it sprawls in our laps like a gangly doll. When the storm kicks up and nothing is ours, we go chasing after all we're certain to lose. So alive, faces radiant with panic.
Tracy K. Smith and The Weather in Space from her new collection, Life on Mars. And there we are at the end of poem number one, Faces Radiant with Panic. I love that line. But what's the deal? Are you a poet or philosopher here? Is God being or pure force? It sounds like we're into Kant country there. The next minute, you've got the gangly doll and we're in poetry. How do you look at the balance of those two or the way they interweave?
Well, I think that, you know, we're living every minute of our lives between, you know, big, huge questions that sometimes we articulate and sometimes we keep inside, and then the day-to-day. And what I love about the opportunity that a poem presents is it allows you the utter control to bring both of those realms together and slow time down so you can really move back and forth between them in a way that, you know, is more satisfying and more possible than it is in real time.
Let us have more of that. You've got the wonderful long poem, My God, It's Full of Stars. And I wonder if you could just read from the first section for us here. You get us out into that realm of space a little bit, but also very, very much at home.
Okay. We like to think of it as parallel to what we know, only bigger. One man against the authorities, or one man against a city of zombies. One man who is not, in fact, a man, sent to understand the caravan of men now chasing him like red ants let loose down the pants of America. Man on the run, man with a ship to catch, a payload to drop, this message going out to all of space. Though maybe it's more like life below the sea, silent, buoyant, bizarrely benign, relics of an outmoded design. Some like to imagine a cosmic mother watching through a spray of stars, mouthing, yes, yes, as we toddle toward the light, biting her lip if we teeter at some ledge. Longing to sweep us to her breast, she hopes for the best, while the father storms through adjacent rooms, ranting with the force of kingdom come, not caring anymore what might snap us in its jaw. Sometimes, what I see is a library in a rural community, all the tall shelves in the big open room, and the pencils in a cup at circulation, gnawed on by the entire population. The books have lived here all along, belonging for weeks at a time to one or another in the brief sequence of family names, speaking, at night mostly, to a face, a pair of eyes, the most remarkable lies.
Tracy K. Smith reading from My God, It's Full of Stars. What a great line. Lots of great lines. And you sure do get range by going, having the sort of nebula at one end and somebody reading a book at night alone. A pair of eyes, the most remarkable lies. That's a wonderful line. What does it mean?
I think that what I was thinking about in terms of that image was the way that the conversation that happens when you're reading a book feels like it's meant completely for you, and like it came into being mm-hmm. when you opened the book. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's not at all how it was. And of course, the truth that you find there, whether or not it is true, won't stay true forever. I think it's responsible for creating a powerful wish in the reader, and that wish and maybe the lie that it's built upon is what's more important, perhaps.
The lie is working for me in your collection, okay. Life on Mars. Give us enough autobiography that we can understand a little bit more about this wonderful kind of celestial imagery and the uses you make of it. It's partly from American popular culture of your youth, but partly directly from the work of your own father.
Right. When I first started writing these poems, I was mostly concerned with that pop culture element, thinking about ways of bringing the 60s and 70s sci-fi aesthetic into language. And so it was almost a playful wish that I had. And as I got further and further into the writing of this book, my father became ill and died. And only then did I remember, A, that he was a tremendous sci-fi fan. He would, you know, I was watching a lot of those films with him growing up, and he would read, you know, science fiction novels. And then, B, that he actually had a hand in part of the imagery that I was thinking about in writing this book. He worked in the early 80s for a company that was making the lenses for the Hubble Space Telescope. And I remember him talking about what this was going to be able to reveal. And I was young. I was 7 or 8. I didn't know exactly what it meant, but I remember the joy and energy that he brought to any opportunity to talk about this device. But it didn't resonate fully for me until I kind of got further into the process of grieving his death. And then all these memories kind of announced themselves.
Your father, looking up into all of that, you've got this great line. The first few pictures came back blurred from the Hubble telescope later, I guess. And I felt ashamed, you write, for all the cheerful engineers, my father and his tribe. The second time the optics jibed, we saw to the edge of all there is, so brutal and alive, it seemed to comprehend us back. I'm not the only one who noticed a little echo of Nietzsche there. I stare into the abyss, and the abyss will stare back at you. But what do you feel comprehending back when you look out at all that vastness?
Well, I guess it depends on when. When I was thinking about, when I was writing these lines, I was wanting that presence to be something like my father and whatever he now has become a part of. And of course, you look at these images and they look like paintings. It's almost impossible to imagine that this is real and that we're a part of whatever system has produced this. And so then there's that other thing. And, you know, maybe you want to call it God, maybe you want to call it the universe itself as some sort of a sentient being. But the largeness of that makes you feel as if you're subject to some particular gaze, and I love that. I love the idea that there's some sort of mirroring that's happening.
And then at the edges here, we've got, and we'll come to your father. There's some very moving writing here on his death and thoughts of life and death, the cosmos, our place in it, great and small. But you've also got David Bowie and Charlton Heston and Stanley Kubrick, waltzing's the wrong word, but dancing through your poetry here. What brings them in?
Well, I felt like it would be almost a lie if I didn't allow these figures who were, to me were kind of the anchors of this you know era, the space, the science fiction era in America, and also in terms of Bowie, I mean his Starman persona. And not only that, but the role that he's played in my imagination for so many years, it seems like I would have been shielding a whole realm of my life from the poems if I didn't bring those figures in. And once I did let them in, it was kind of wonderful to feel like I was able to interact with them, you know.
Oh, yeah. I get the Stanley Kubrick. I mean, all those wonderful images. We saw them in the Tree of Life. We see them on your cover, these distant images, far distant, that the Hubble brought us back. They're very Starman-y. Charlton Heston, I guess, from the Omega Man, he had some sci-fi roles himself where he was pretty grand, like the cosmos.
Yeah, grand in a way that also makes you realize how small we really are. You know, I love what I love about those movies is, you know, there are moments where it's just kitsch, and it feels like a kind of a wonderful balance that he kind of teeters upon between gesturing toward these important questions and then slipping into a moment where, you know, you almost feel as if you were like, this has gone toward the B movie realm. But I think that's wonderful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with poet Tracy K. Smith about life, the cosmos, the big questions, the small moments. Charlton Heston, David Bowie. Her new collection of poems is Life on Mars. Tracy, I wish you just to help people get a feeling for this, and they're responding plenty here online. Greg says, in the movie Contact, Dr. Arroway looks out at the beauty of the galaxy and whispers, they should have sent a poet. Of course, he writes, we need to send science, scientists and poets. But we should read just a little more from My God, It's Full of Stars. There's a section here where you think about our place in that vast universe, and you go from the cosmos to the bowl of your father's pipe.
Okay. Perhaps the great error is believing we're alone, that the others have come and gone, a momentary blip, when all along space might be chock full of traffic, bursting at the seams with energy we neither feel nor see, flush against us, living, dying, deciding, setting solid feet down on planets everywhere, bowing to the great stars that command, pitching stones at whatever are their moons. They live wondering if they are the only ones, knowing only the wish to know, and the great black distance they, we, flicker in. Maybe the dead know, their eyes widening at last, seeing the high beams of a million galaxies flick on at twilight, hearing the engines flare, the horns not letting up, the frenzy of being. I want it to be one notch below bedlam, like a radio without a dial. Wide open so everything floods in at once, and sealed tight so nothing escapes, not even time, which should curl in on itself and loop around like smoke, so that I might be sitting now beside my father as he raises a lit match to the bowl of his pipe for the first time in the winter of 1959.
My God, It's Full of Stars is the poem. Tracy K. Smith is the poet. She's with us. And there's plenty of the cosmos and her father here. And there, Tracy, that desire, anyone who's lost someone knows it, that time be malleable, that we be able to move through it, that it loop around like smoke, that you can sit with your father at that time when you weren't even born.
Right. Every time I found myself feeling free to move into this imagined space escape, I would get to a certain place and the urge that was a private urge for me would kind of like nudge its way in. And as I was reading that poem, I really can feel it happening from the first stanza to the second, which begins, maybe the dead know. Suddenly, yeah. I'm thinking about my dead and wanting to imagine a space that they can move freely in and understand. And I feel like, you know, Elegy is really about wanting to stop time and move backwards and understand. And I feel like the universe, we know so much and so little of it, and the nature of it seems circular. So it really seemed like a great setting for taking that kind of liberty with time and nature and feeling.
I love the intimacy of those very grand themes and subjects, and then right down to the bowl of his pipe and that single match lit there. But of course, as a radio guy, I also love your million galaxies, like a radio without a dial wide open so everything floods in at once and sealed tight so nothing escapes. Fantastic. Eric in Constable, New York is calling. Eric, you're on the air with Tracy K. Smith.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi.
Unlike you, I was raised by a father who at every dinner table heard the railing on of Walter Reuther and the socialist movement. And I was always intrigued by one thing that my mother used to say to me. She was a Bible person, and she said, there once was a man named Job. And I was intrigued by that statement my entire life, how the Bible could encapsulate in one phrase how one man was so important enough and yet not important enough to be recognized.
It's chapter 1, verse 1 of the book of Job, I think, Eric. There happened to be a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job.
There happened to be a man, and yet this man has been extolled and put on high for centuries. And yet I find it very poetic. Do you not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the loss after loss that's visited upon this individual, and the range of emotions and questions that raises, and this you know, fidelity, I guess, to belief and to the God that he worships.
But also a kind of understanding of the cosmos and life, just in that phrasing that Eric reminds us of, there happened to be a man. You know, it's the kind of suggestion of the accidental in that existence that gets out into some of the turf you wrestle with here.
Yeah, I you know, so much of our experience, I guess, is based upon accidents, right? Happy accidents and the other kind. And the meaning that we're able to derive from those, emotions aside, I think is what enriches our time here. And I guess language does something wonderful too, because it allows us to, you know, there happened to be, and then insert your name here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way that you become part of that continuum.
No matter where you sit, no matter the view you have. Thanks for your call, Eric. I appreciate it very much. Let's get one more. Roger in Edinburgh, Virginia. Roger, you're on the air with Tracy Smith.
Hi, Tom. Just an observation. When Ms. Smith was discussing whether you believe in God or whatever, in Hebrews, the New Testament, I think it's Hebrews 1, verse 4, it mentions that God made the world. And that's not to pontificate, but it is an observation that's something that we could think about, that there are other worlds. And thank you so much. Enjoy the show.
Roger, thanks for calling. There's the intentionality of that God. The question you raise right at the top, you know, is he pure force, being or pure force, making or being? Do you reach a conclusion, Tracy? Do you care to?
Well, I think that my conclusion in some ways is rooted in my own upbringing, and I also grew up, you know, going to church on Sundays, and so there's a being there for me. But when I felt myself in contact with the force of that being in terms of, you know, something or someone capable of bringing a life away, or taking a life away, I needed to expand upon the definition or the image of God that I had grown up with. And that's, I think, where the questions that are swirling around in these poems come from. I didn't feel content with the God that I was familiar with. because there seemed like so much more than had been explained to me was happening. I think God in this book is shape-shifting, you know, mm-hmm. and I needed that kind of amplitude to maybe feel like I was not, I don't think you ever really come to terms with grief, but that I had stepped into a more comfortable kind of proximity with what my father's death made happen.
There's a very small word that you find a cosmos in and unpack wonderfully in this collection, the word it, I-T, it. Some people hear that and go back to God. Others go in very, very different directions. You seem to go off into a realm of what completely cosmic scale mysteries may be, or maybe you deflate that mysterious it a little bit. You've got a poem called It and Co., as in company. It and Co. I wonder if you could read for us, Tracy.
Of course. We are a part of it, not guests. Is it us or what contains us? How can it be anything but an idea, something teetering on the spine of the number I? It is elegant but coy. It avoids the blunt ends of our fingers as we point. We have gone looking for it everywhere, in Bibles and bandwidth, blooming like a wound from the ocean floor. Still, it resists the matter of false versus real. Unconvinced by our zeal, it is unappeasable. It is like some novels, vast and unreadable.
It and Co., from Tracy K. Smith's terrific collection, Life on Mars. We've got a response online. Brett has written, I've never really seen myself as a guest of the universe, more of a tenant. We're all tenants in a manner of speaking. Let's hope the universe is more forgiving, he writes, than some landlords, Tracy. He says, I wonder how long after the eviction notice do we earthlings have to evacuate? But this it is large, and you're, in some ways, you're trying to deflate or escape some of that kind of overbearing majesty of mystery here.
I wanted to find a place for myself inside of it, and I didn't feel like I could approach something that was as majestic and omnipotent as some of the versions of whatever, you know, whatever's behind everything, you know, the wizard. And I needed to take it apart a little bit. I needed to know that something as small and confused and messy and indecisive as me belonged.
Peter in Shoreham, Vermont, you're on the air with Tracy Smith. Peter, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tracy. I appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you. I, too, am a very a poet of sorts, and I believe that that our job here on Earth, that we're all just points of perspective on the universe, and the universe doesn't exist without our perspective. And I think that's our job, and that the dark matter or dark force that it keeps expanding in the universe is our wonder, our sense of wonder. And I believe poetry is that catalyst for that force, and that is the importance to humanity and to the universe. We are, that it's as simple as that, I believe. It is, there's no complications, that we all just generate that wonder that expands the universe forever.
Peter, I love it, and I appreciate your call. It's funny, Tracy, we had the philosopher, physicist David Deutsch on recently with a very grand view of the cosmos and the universe and the human place in it. But what do you say as a poet to that perspective that, you know, it's the wonder of human observation that makes the world? Is a poet that powerful?
I think that's a really beautiful way of looking at things, and I think that the world as we know it, a large part of it is driven by that. But I also have to look at so much that troubles and concerns me, and I feel like there's another side to it, and it's not wonder, but it's maybe you could call it will or desire. But the damage that we're capable of inflicting upon ourselves and the environment, and without even wanting to necessarily, seems like it's maybe the B side of that coin that wonder is printed on. So, and maybe, you know, that's another big reason why I want to keep asking questions within the poems, to kind of be able to go back and forth between the wonder and the wish and what's fruitful and positive, and this sense that I have of reality, which is frightening but doesn't go away.
Let's give a little antidote to some of that frightening angle. It's not all cosmos and stars here. You've got a wonderful poem called The Good Life. I wonder if you could read for us.
Oh, sure. The Good Life. When some people talk about money, they speak as if it were a mysterious lover who went out to buy milk and never came back. And it makes me nostalgic for the years I lived on coffee and bread, hungry all the time, walking to work on payday like a woman journeying for water from a village without a well. Then living one or two nights like everyone else on roast chicken and red wine.
For one or two nights. For one or two nights. The Good Life from Tracy Smith there. Was that you? Hungry all that the time as the penniless poet at the beginning of your...
That was absolutely me.
Like a woman journeying for water?
Yeah. I mean, that's the truth of the subjective, you know? Like, I remember those times believing that, you know, the future was going to get better, but living in a present that felt destitute on a scale that was much larger than it actually was. I feel like that's a funny poem, too, you know, a little bit.
Yes, it is. How do you get the courage to keep walking that woman journeying for water, in your case, you know, writing poetry and keeping going and hoping that it's picked up? I mean, it seems, talk about stepping off into space. You know, the life of a poet seems really to embody that.
Well, something I tell my students and tell myself is that... poetry is something that you should think of as a completely private endeavor. You know, I've always heard, you know, when people talk about writing, that the reader is someone you should be thinking of and thinking about getting through to. And I really disagree with that, at least in those first few drafts. I feel like a poem is really this chance that you have of thinking about what's important to you and getting inside of it. If it's a memory, you're able to hit rewind on your life and go back and have access to an experience that in reality happened and then went away. If it's something that doesn't really connect to your life in a literal way, you have the opportunity to create a bridge into this other person's experience. And for me, that's utterly a private, selfish wish. And it's about wanting to have understanding and access. The other thing, you know, the public side of it is something that I think is wonderful and important, but it's also a little bit accidental. And I think it's very much secondary to what motivates me to sit down and read or to sit down and put words down on
paper.
But
it's not just an intellectual journey, though it certainly is that. Sean Singer reads you and... he says, your collection here gives materiality to Victor Martinez's statement that poetry is the essence of thinking. But you also put it so compellingly. Is that pleasure for your own ears really there?
I think so. I mean, every poet seems to have a love of language and words, and the music of language is something that I think is probably on the surface of the poetic impulse. And I think that doesn't go away no matter how intense the ideas become.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with poet Tracy K. Smith about life, the cosmos, the big questions, the small moments, grief and love and birth, about Charlton Heston and David Bowie. Her new collection is Life on Mars. Her father was an engineer, worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. A little bit of that and more rubbed off on her latest collection of poems. Tracy K. Smith joins us from New York today. Lots of reaction online here. Russell wants to find out if you have a husband, Tracy. It would be great. He says, what a gorgeous, brilliant spirit. Ellen says, poetry needs to reclaim its power. I think you're doing that right here, right now. Rose is calling from Plainville, Connecticut. Rose, you're on the air with Tracy Smith.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I like Tracy Smith's poetry, and I'm math science oriented. My big observation is this. It seems to me that most poets are thrilled by their own words and their non sequitur flights of fancy. Tracy Smith is not this way. I shall buy her book, and I shall buy at least two copies for friends.
I don't think they'll be disappointed. It is terrific. And you're right. There's a materiality in it at the same time as it goes to very, very big ideas. Tracy, Rose is a scientist. What did your engineer father make of your urge to poetry?
I think he was happy that I loved to read and write, which were things that he had encouraged all of my siblings and me to do. And I think when I told him after graduating from college that I was going to become a poet, he was also very frightened and wanted to make sure that I was going to be able to, you know, take care of myself and the world.
Right. But how will you live, daughter? How will you live?
Exactly. Yeah. There was a moment when I remember sensing that his fear had gone away. And it was when at some party he said, "This is my daughter, the poet." And I felt like, okay, I've gotten through to him. And that's, you know, the biggest obstacle.
He grew up black in the 1940s in Sunflower, Alabama, I read here, Tracy. Yes. Went into the Air Force and then on to do the work you describe on the Hubble telescope. You know, there's a kind of freedom in poetry that I don't know, that hip-hop artists may partake of. But as an African-American, did he see you as especially vulnerable stepping out into that realm of written artistry?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think that there's a tradition of literature by African Americans,
and definitely.
That he was definitely, you know, aware of as well. But I think the realities of making a living with words that very few people were willing to read, and that many people didn't feel like they had, you know, as much access to as you know, fiction. I think that was, you know, a realistic concern that he had. But I know that once that fear went away for him, it was really wonderful. I mean, he was a math science person as well. And so to see him make moves toward stepping into that lexicon, and stepping into the kind of space that a poem creates and wanting to understand what I was saying and also to find signs of his daughter that he knew, I thought that was a really wonderful kind of connection.
Was he poetic about it, the science, what he saw through that lens when he looked out, when we all looked out through Hubble to see that space you describe as so brutal and alive, it seemed to comprehend us back? Was your father poetic about that view?
Well, I wish, to be really honest with you, wish I had understood more at the time, mm-hmm. so I could have spoken with him about it. But I do remember that he would show me photographs, and there was something like rapture that characterized his bearing when that happened. And I feel like that's the feeling that I get when I read a poem that gets through to me on a very powerful level. He was feeling that by seeing these things that he also understood in a way that I don't and didn't, and that he felt probably a kind of personal connection to because he had been a part of the process of getting those.
It's great to read a daughter probing back in, perhaps to a father's mind, not to make it too personal, but you write, "My father spent whole seasons bowing before the oracle eye, hungry for what it would find." And you've got a beautiful elegy as well in this collection for your dad. It's called "The Speed of Belief." You write in one portion about a memory, I guess, of a night long ago, remembered or imagined. You can tell us when his father had died and how he responded then. And you thinking years later, is this from memory? Are you imagining in "The Speed of Belief" your father's own experience of losing a father?
This is my attempt to really access a memory that I have that's vague. Mm-hmm. I was young when his father died, and I remember him going off to be at the funeral and to be with his family and not knowing a whole lot, not knowing what kinds of feelings he had because I didn't know anything about death at the time. And I wanted to go back to that moment for this poem, so I'll read it. "When your own sweet father died, you woke before first light and ate half a plate of eggs and grits and drank a glass of milk. After you'd left, I sat in your place and finished the toast bits with jam and the cold eggs, the thick bacon flanged in fat, savoring the taste. Then I slept, too young to know how narrow and grave the road before you seemed. All the houses zipped tight, the night's few clouds muddy as cold coffee. You stayed gone a week, and who were we without your clean profile nicking away at anything that made us afraid? One neighbor sent a cake. We ate the baked chickens, the honeyed hams. We bowed our heads and prayed you'd come back safe, knowing you would.
Tracy Smith reading from The Speed of Belief there in memoriam for her father, Floyd William Smith, 1935 to 2008. I've seen you say that when your mother died, which was much earlier, you didn't yet have this sort of perspective or maturity to fully grieve, but by the time your father did, just a couple of years ago, you had access to that we're hearing here.
Yeah, I think that I was 22 when my mother passed away, and I felt that loss, but I don't know that I was able to speak back to it or even fully allow myself to express those feelings, even though I was trying to write about her. And it wasn't until my father passed away that I felt like there was something that I was able to listen to and to imagine and to draw from that not only allowed me to feel like I was able to say goodbye to him and to imagine this other realm that he might have stepped into, but it did the same thing for that initial loss of her. I think that's probably something that happens, and I imagine that every future loss is going to give me a renewed kind of access to those early ones.
There's some kind of compensation.
Yeah.
It's terrible, but great. Patrick in Boston, you're on the air with Tracy Smith.
Hi. Let's see. I wanted to quickly say three things. First, I read the article about you in the New Yorker, and I think you're really cool. And two, question, do you think it's a poet's role or, I guess, job to, quote-unquote, soothe humanity, to sort of take care of humanity and make life seem less, I guess, painful? And then third, advice for a poet who would love to get published somewhere.
Okay.
Those are great. Tracy.
I like Lucille Clifton. She passed away recently, and her statement about why she writes is something that I think is so perfect. She says, "I write to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable." And I think that, in a way, is what a good poem does. It does something for the loss that we live with, and it also does something to shake us up out of a sense of complacency and to make us think there's something we must do.
So not just to soothe, though there is soothing there for those who need the soothing, which
right.
At some point we all do.
Yeah, we all do, but there's something we've got to do with that mm-hmm. greater security that soothing brings into being. And I love that idea that a poem isn't something that just lets you sit down and say,
yes.
It makes you responsible for something.
And what about Patrick, who's out there, you know, pounding the page himself, looking for that way to make it over the first kind of hurdles into a realm you're now in, honored, lots of prizes, a position at Princeton, teaching while you write. How do you get on the path?
It's a long path, but it's something that is worth committing to and, you know, buckling down for. Reading, I always tell my students, read as much as you can and read against taste. Don't just read the poets that you immediately like, but see if you can learn something from the poets that you find difficult. And I think community is something that's very important. If you have a group of two or four friends who write, who you trust, and with whom you might be willing to share your own writing, then that's going to be sustaining, and it's also likely to help you improve your craft as a writer. I think those are things that still continue to make me feel like I can keep going.
Sybil in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with Tracy Smith.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling in basically to address the question, is God a being or a force? Was that the question earlier?
Yes.
Well, I was raised in a fundamentalist church, probably not too surprising since you know, I'm in the South, and I would say that the God that I was taught has definitely changed over my many decades of searching, and I now go to a spiritual center, and a light just went on because the minister said, Jesus said God is love. God doesn't love. God is love, the force, the energy. And we believe that we can release that love and that divinity in each of us.
Sybil, I appreciate that observation very much, and I'm glad for you calling in with it. If you'll permit me, I want to take us right from that kind of observation on divinity to get very close to the creation of life itself with a poem from Tracy Smith. Tracy, with Sybil's question in mind, you've got this great poem, When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me, addressed to a child looking back on the moment of that child's conception. Talk about creation of life, talking about being or force or making things happen. Could you read that for us?
Of course. When your small form tumbled into me, I lay sprawled like a big game rug across the bed, belly down, legs wishbone wide. It was winter, workaday. Your father swung his feet to the floor. The kids upstairs dragged something back and forth on shrieking wheels. I was empty, blown through by whatever swells, swirling, and then breaks night after night upon that room. You must have watched for what felt like forever, wanting to be what we passed back and forth between us like fire, wanting weight, desiring desire, dying to descend into flesh, fault, the brief ecstasy of being. From what dream of world did you wriggle free? What soared and what grieved when you aimed your will at the yes of my body, alive like that on the sheets?
Tracy Smith's When Your Small Form Tumbled Into Me, just an astonishingly wonderful poem. So here we have Sybil in Nashville thinking of God as love, you on the sheets creating life, and then addressing this to a child who I assume now lives and will one day read this poem.
Yeah. Well, one day probably dislike that poem.
At a certain age, at a certain young age, maybe dislike, and then at an older age. I think it's a daughter, right?
Yes, it is.
So what woman doesn't think about that moment? What man, for that matter? But that's a pretty cosmically consequential moment.
I think that the coincidence of becoming pregnant soon after my father died put my mind in motion to try and connect, you know, try and understand that there must be some sort of a relationship between losing him and then having this person take shape suddenly inside of me. And I always thought of it not so much as like creating life, but as just being somehow receptive to what is always happening somehow in ways that we don't yet fully understand in the universe or in space. And I loved that image of this little cosmic being that was waiting to descend into Brooklyn.
Dying to descend into flesh, wanting weight and getting it. I can't get enough of this. I wish you'd read just a little bit more for us. Our time is short, but don't you wonder sometimes, as a bit on Bowie, David Bowie, and you've got this wonderful light kind of glittering Bowie thread through here as well. Jump in if you would. Our time is short.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Bowie is among us, right here in New York City, in a baseball cap and expensive jeans, ducking into a deli, flashing all those teeth at the doorman on his way back up, or he's hailing a taxi on Lafayette as the sky clouds over at dusk. He's in no rush, doesn't feel the way you'd think he feels, doesn't strut or gloat, tells jokes. He's got the whole world under his foot, and we are small alongside, though there are occasions when a man his size can meet your eyes for just a blip of time and send a thought like, shine, 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 straight to your mind. Bowie, I want to believe you, want to feel your will like the wind before rain, the kind everything simply obeys, swept up in that hypnotic dance, as if something with the power to do so had looked its way and said, go ahead.
Tracy Smith's Don't You Wonder Sometimes. Our listeners, our callers want to talk about God, and you've got Bowie. But they're not unrelated. Not that Bowie's God, but you've got that life flowing all over the place.
Small step between the two. I loved, you know, obviously the title of this collection is taken directly from Bowie's wonderful song, Life on Mars. And I loved the way that the personas that he's moved through in his career have been world creating for so many of us. And I just felt like I needed to borrow a little bit of that or nod toward that in a very overt public way. Also to say that poetry, as serious as it is also about play.
You make it very clear, and you make it very playful and really wonderful. It's just a terrific collection. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it, and I'm really grateful to you for sharing some time with us today, Tracy. Thanks so very, very much for coming on.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tracy K. Smith, she's a poet and professor of creative writing at Princeton University. Her collections include The Body's Question, Duende, and her latest, Life on Mars. To read selections of her poetry, go to our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. Great phrases. Faces radiant with panic. I won't forget it soon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for being here.